five-year rule at that time. I mean, I may have been that didn't come into my decision at all. There were several things that came into my decision. Number one was I felt I ought to get into something that was directly related to the war effort. Number two was this very exciting combination of requirements for the job: chemical engineering plus applied chemistry plus polymer chemistry plus new polymer chemistry polymers, organosilicon polymers had not been exploited before, were particularly exciting. It was that combination that drew me over to General Electric. And in retrospect, it was such a fortunate combination, because what they had to have at that time was the development of processes to take that direct process reaction of methyl chloride and silicon from the bed scale to the commercial scale. And I was fortunately just equipped with chemical engineering background and applied chemistry background and polymer interest to work on those problems.
Did you know Carruthers at all?
No.
Did you have anything to do with the people at DuPont?
I interviewed DuPont for a job on a couple of occasions, and I knew quite a number of people who went to work for DuPont who were classmates of mine. Mm-hmm. And that brings me to one other point. You mentioned, what about my peers at MIT? Looking back on it, the most remarkable records of a group of people, one you mentioned, DuPont, one of my classmates, wound up as a officer in DuPont. He was helped by the fact that his mother was a DuPont, but he was a very good man himself. He ran their neoprene operations for years and all their rubber operations for years.
Who was that?
Charles Harrington. He's an MIT alumnus. And his father was a DuPont executive committee member. And his mother was a daughter of, I think, one of Lamont DuPont's siblings, brothers and sisters. Then another fellow who was a faculty member at the time I was there was Robert Hershey. He wound up running all of DuPont's polymer operations for years and was a vice president. A classmate of mine going clear back to high school by the name of Norman Copeland, who took his graduate work at MIT in mechanical engineering, wound up as chief engineer at DuPont. He passed away a couple of years ago.
Wasn't he a CEO at one time?
No, he was an executive committee member at DuPont, but not a CEO. Yeah. Another classmate of mine by the name of Fred Holloway wound up as the chief technical officer of Exxon. Another one a couple years before me, but he was my boss at the MIT Practice School in 1936, wound up being president of Standard in Indiana.
Did anyone else come up? It seemed like MIT had the reputation of being a pipeline to DuPont. And,
they did. I was the first fellow that ever went to General Electric. I mean, you know, at that time they would say, what's the chemical engineer doing in General Electric? That's where I was so fortunate to be the first one there. There was no competition.
people still don't understand what chemists have to do with General Electric.
Well, I hope they do more and more, because, you know, it's such a big, big polymer operation today. But as you say, you talk to the average person, they wonder what chemists do with General Electric.
Now, just as an aside, we always have a problem getting our PhD candidates to
think of it in
General Electric.
Sure. Another one, Jerry McAfee, a classmate of mine, wound up being the CEO of now defunct Gulf Oil. But it was a big job. He retired about the time it was swallowed up by Standard of California. And just any number of classmates in that graduate class wound up with very good, very responsible positions in the chemical industry. Chemical engineers were flying very high as the petrochemical industry developed.
When you interviewed DuPont, did you meet Paul Flory?
No, I was interviewed by some people at their Bell, West Virginia plant, where they were in polymer production. That was the plant where they were really planning to do the big production of methyl methacrylate, which is called Pontolite in those days. That was the first name for the acrylate polymers. I think that's a defunct name now, but
we hope so.
Pontolite was what they called it then.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Standard of New Jersey, as I said, for a job, and several others, but I wasn't ready to leave until the GE thing. The confluence of influences around GE led me to leave.
So your job at GE from the first was 100% to get the direct process?
My job at GE, it was very, I don't think there'd be any place in the world that would manage these things the way they were managed in GE in those days. I mean, Marshall in the chemical section, or whatever you call it in those days, it was a group of chemists under Marshall, had this process under development. Rockhow had made the dummy original chemistry where he passed methyl chloride, as you know, through a static bed of silicon copper alloy and came out with methyl chlorosilanes. It was very interesting. I was just reviewing last night. I bought a book. I may have it. I don't have it with me, but I did have it here. A fellow from Brooklyn Poly has just come out with a text that reviews the history of the polymer industry up through 1960.
Morrowitz?
Just came out.
Yeah.
I bought that book because I'm interested quite generally in keeping up on the polymer industry. He has practically nothing after 1960.
Yeah,
nothing. But he has one paragraph devoted to Rockhow's work.
Yeah.
And he goes back in that paragraph, and I hadn't realized it, that the first use of copper-silicon alloy, I guess, was back in 1895. I think he unearthed something back that far where they passed chloroform over silicon alloy, or HCl, and they got some kind of reaction that never amounted to anything, but there was in the literature the reaction of chloride compounds with the copper-silicon alloy. Well, you know the story of Rockhow finally getting an alloy that turned out to work, and as with so many new inventions, there was some luck involved in his getting a reactive copper-silicon alloy. It's not too hard to get an unreactive one.
Yeah.
But he did this the way a chemist would normally do it, by packing copper-silicon alloy, or a mixture of copper and silicon, not an alloy, but a mixture of the two, into a tube and having a heating element around it, and vaporizing methyl chloride, passing it through the bed and condensing a product. And then they had to analyze that. The analysts analyzed it by fractional distillation in those days and separated out all of the various monomers. And Rockhow, using these monomers, did his original work on the methyl silicone polymers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a highly exothermic reaction. And if you pass, and if you get the reaction going too fast, you get a lot of kinking in the tube, and the tube stops up, and you can't get any more gas through it. And the problem of expanding this from a small tube, maybe an inch in diameter, to something where you could produce pounds per day, even rather than grams per day, that would be a 450-fold increase in scale from where Rockhouse started out, was quite formidable. Well, it was obvious to me that the thing to do was to try to do it in a fluid bed, because that was the answer in to getting better heat transfer and better temperature control. So my first efforts were to develop that were on two fronts. They were to develop better, more effective methods that could be scaled up in carrying out the reaction itself. That meant developing a different kind of reactor. And it meant also developing a scale-up of distillation. Well, before you could develop the scale-up of distillation, again, it was obvious to a chemical engineer, and not to the chemists who weren't thinking that way, that you had to have equilibrium data on the various methylchlorosilane. So again, one of the first things I did was to set up a program to develop the necessary vapor-liquid equilibrium data on the different chlorosilanes. And I had a young man who was graduating in 1942 in course 10, really extremely outstanding student of mine, by the name of Jerome P. Cole, I talked him into coming to MIT, to Schenectady, in the GE Research Laboratory, which I thought was quite a coup at the time, because, as you say, no one had ever gone to, but he knew me, and I was able to get him over there, and his first job was to develop experimental data on vapor liquid equilibrium. But when we got that, we were able to do a rational design of a distillation column, a batch distillation column for separating the methylchlorosilanes, and we were able to rationally place an order with the Foster Wheeler people for a 6-inch diameter packed column, which was up from maybe 1 inch that they were using in the laboratory to separate these things from the very small scale reactors.
What kind of packed column?
This was called a Stedman column. And Stedman packing had been developed by Foster Wheeler for use in the petroleum industry, and was really the first structured packing material that enabled them to develop large-scale packed columns of very high efficiency with what we call the height of a theoretical plate of maybe a few inches rather than a few feet that was common to packing before that period. So we went into a Stedman, were able to order a 6-inch Stedman that put us into separating pounds per day as against grams per day previously.
When you say these things were obvious to you, it's because the petroleum industry was doing a lot of this.
I was trained as a chemical engineer, and I saw it all going on in the petroleum industry.
And it wasn't obvious to GE people. They didn't have experience.
They didn't have experience. They'd never heard of fluid bed reactors, and they didn't. And the chemists just weren't oriented to distillation on an industrial scale. You know, it was like taking candy from a baby.
The classic example is they'd never had a chemical engineer.
They had never had a chemical engineer. I say I was really fortunate in having this combination of training and no competition.
How to rise.
That's right. So I came to the attention, you know, of the right people. And they were impressed.
As far as polymers, was their sophistication similar on the level of yours?
Oh, they were terribly sophisticated in the polymers. Oh, yes, and excellent people. And as I say, I remember after being there a month, Maynard Agins came through with silicone rubber, and they had a few people in the lab who were very skilled in compounding. Again, you ought to turn the instrument off, but they called it shit mixing in the GE research laboratory. So they were very skilled in mixing anything under the sun in, you know, as a filler in rubber. They had just been through polyvinyl chloride. They did a lot of very excellent work on polyvinyl chloride. And, of course, they had been studying that as insulation for years. They've been studying rubber as insulation for years. So they were very well equipped to take a hold of a new rubber and put it through its paces as far as compounding was concerned. They mix everything into it and were able to get a lot of good patents in the very early stage. A fellow by the name of Gil Wright was one of the world's best compounders. He knew all these obscure kinds of things that you could mix in.
And was that all going on at Pittsfield?
No, this was all in Schenectady. And there was some rivalry developing, not in the Pittsfield Plastics Department, but in the Transformer Department, which had a very good laboratory. And which also had a lot of people that wanted to see the company move forward in chemistry, chemical manufacturing, because they were ambitious chemists. We had a very good director there by the name of Gifford, under whom PCBs were developed for transformers, and of course that was a revolutionary development in its day, and they did all the work on the polychlorinated diphenyls in the Pittsfield laboratory, and were very chemically oriented on new materials for use in electrical apparatus. So they started a little program of their own on transferring the direct process from the laboratory to a larger scale, and even build a small pilot plant, but they never got onto the fluid bed aspects of it. And the interesting thing is, I built a fluid bed unit that on a small scale could really turn out a couple of drums of this material a day. That would be maybe, you know, for a short time, on one run, you might turn out several hundred pounds of the material, and that greatly impressed the GE people. But the fluid bed process is a very difficult process to scale up. I mean, it works beautifully at larger scales, but on a small scale, you have all kinds of practical problems on plugging up pipes and filtering out particles from gas suspensions. And it really took us 18 years before we got up to a large enough scale that we could build a fluid bed process in actual production. And we had to go into production in the very early pilot plants on a scaled up, just simply a scaled up version of static beds. We had a laboratory in the Schenectady Works, again, that was in connection with a thread of interest in General Electric chemistry, making insulating materials. GE had gotten into alkyd chemistry very early in the game, because alkyds were not only of interest as the basis for certain insulating materials, but turned out then to be the basis for coating materials. And GE back in the late 20s and 30s, out of the research, in the research laboratory, developed early alkyd resins, and they then did exploit that to make insulating varnishes, and from insulating varnishes they went into coating materials, and had a business developed to make alkyd resins for the coating industry in the 1930s. They were skilled in making varnishes and wire enamels in that business, and out of the research laboratory came Formbar enamels. And this was polyvinyl formal placed in solution to make an enamel. It turned out to be, in its day, the world's best coating for wire, because it was a very tough insulating coating that was good at higher temperatures. And the lab also, the Schenectady lab also did the pioneering work on plasticizing polyvinyl chloride for flexible insulation. Well, this group was very interested in seeing the company advance into chemical manufacturing, and
this is the transformer.
This is now the insulating materials group that's connecting. This is the second group. The first group I talked about was transformer. They aspired to get into chemical manufacturing because of their experience with dimethyls, the pyranols, as they called them in those days. The second group I'm talking about came up through the insulation side. They were not oriented toward any one particular type of electrical apparatus, but more toward rotating apparatus rather than transformers. And they were responsible for mica insulation, which was of great importance in turbine generators and large motors. And that GE had integrated very early in the game into making its own insulation for turbine generators and for large motors, because it turned out that the insulation, the quality of the insulation, was the bottleneck in what you could do in scaling up your rotating equipment. So, and they were, since they were responsible for making varnishes that would be insulating varnishes for mica, they coated cloth to make insulation. Coated cloth was used as insulation in many motors and in cables. Mm-hmm. And they had a big cable manufacturing plant in Schenectady. So here was a group that was oriented toward insulating varnishes. So they knew about varnishes. They knew about alkyd varnishes. They knew about alkyd coating materials. And they were located physically near the research laboratory that was trying to bring silicones along. So the lab tried very hard to get them to take on the responsibility of pushing these processes from the laboratory to commercial scale. And they did take on the responsibility, and they developed a reactor called a stirred bed reactor, where you have a large cylindrical vessel, and you have a worm screw rotating inside of that keeps the powder turning over and gives you better heat transfer and better temperature control than you could get if you had just a static bed of powder.
This is a batch process.
This is a batch process.
Like a blender.
Like a blender, yeah, but on a vertical scale. A vertical pipe with a screw, rotating screw inside of it. A cooling material flowing around this pipe on the outside, mm-hmm. and a condenser on top of it, and a boiler to blow the methyl chloride, heat the methyl chloride and blow it through. Mm-hmm. And this was the reactor which we had to go with in the first plant, because the scale of operation was such that we simply could not go for a fluid reactor at that point in time.
Did you recognize it, or did you fight for the fluid bed reactor in the first place?
We recognized it. I mean, it was just too small scale for fluid bed at that time. So I was in charge of the plant design on the first plant.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to go with these fluid bed reactors, stirred bed reactors. But we knew that we would come to the point when when it would be a large enough scale we could put in a real fluid bed. If we had put in a fluid bed reactor, say only 1.5 to 2 feet in diameter, it would have made vastly more chlorosilanes than we could use.
So the market wasn't big enough. You could have developed it,
could have put it in immediately if the market had been there. But what do you do with all these chlorosilanes that are coming out?
So again, this sort of application of engineering economic background rather than technology.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And we just couldn't do it.
What was the problem in building a modified, smaller, fluidized bed reactor?
The problems are just practical in keeping it running. If you build it small enough to balance the amount of chlorosilanes that you can use, and by that I say a million. We were thinking in terms of maybe a few hundred thousand pounds a year. Couldn't even use that much at that time. And then the low millions of pounds per year.
Mm-hmm.
The fluid bed, as we could understand it at that time, was too small. Was impractical on that small scale. And it was just due to a whole series of practical problems. Filters, small pipes stopping up with these gas solid suspensions, and it's only when you get up to maybe 1.5 or 2 feet in this particular reaction that you get something that you can really deal with in a practical way in a plant.
In 1940,
now distillation was quite in contrast to that. We understood distillation so thoroughly that we put some distillation columns in the first silicone plant at Waterford, New York, 1947, that are still being used today. Now, they've got a lot of additional distillation columns that have gone in since, but that shows you, and we understood the materials of construction problems. We could make them out of ordinary steel. And they're running, they're using them today.
So it took 5 years from the time you arrived till the Waterford plant.
Yeah, 5 years.
Yeah.
In the meantime, you transferred in that company operations from the research lab.
Why did you make that
particular move? Just because you wanted
recognized that the best way to transfer technology is to transfer people. And that's why I went down to Insulating Materials Department, because they were taking the responsibility for designing the first plant.
Mm-hmm. How much credit would you really give Marshall Herman Lepofsky and his book?
I give Marshall tremendous credit. Tremendous credit. Because he really sponsored the whole thing and kept with it. And Marshall was a really radical thinker. I mean, he would try anything. He wasn't hidebound at all. He was really in a class by himself as far as a chemist trying new things is concerned.
He was a chemist?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Marshall was from Princeton.
Is he easy to work with? Or?
Well, it depends on whom you talk to. I always got a great kick out of working with him, and he was not what you'd call an organization man. I mean, it was getting down directly to business on the bench. I mean, Marshall would think nothing of coming in at 8 o'clock at night and assuming command of whatever experiment was going on.
Mm-hmm.
or trying something new, but one thing I've heard moving right into the picture.
Yeah, to get a little bit more about Marshall, some of the people who went on to the GE Power business said, although at the early times he pushed GE into the business, later he wasn't very helpful to the business in.
I think that was right, because he, Marshall, got off onto a lot of other things. I mean, I felt that he wasn't particularly helpful in supporting silicones when I was on the other side of the fence running the silicone products department. He had a lot of other irons in the fire then. For example, boron chemistry was very exciting at that time. They were into new chemistry on air conditioning. Their job was to develop new things, you know, for General Electric overall. And silicones was just one more thing that they had bothered and that they felt should go along and always spend more money on its own and do more R&D on its own.
Pause for a moment.